Okay, well, why don't I start now and let people drift in as I'm talking. So let me just clarify what we're going to try and do now. We began with the topological field theory, and this depends only on the complex structure. X. But now we're going to the untwisted theory, and we're going to ask about stability, and this depends on B plus IJ. So everything that I'm going to talk about today is to do with B plus IJ. And last time I introduced the notion of stability with respect to a triangle. And this was got by taking a distinguished triangle in the category and the idea was that there was this real number that I was associating to every arrow on the diagram, xi, and if xi is bigger than 1, then A is unstable. If xi is less than 1, then A is stable with respect to this triangle. And the fly in the ointment about this stuff is that, unfortunately, if you prove that something is unstable or stable with respect to one triangle, you have neither proved that it's stable nor have you proved that it's unstable. The reason why you haven't proved that something is stable is because there might be other triangles with respect to which the object is unstable. And the reason why you haven't proved it's unstable is that you've only proven that A is unstable if both B and C were stable objects that you could decay into. So there's this nasty issue which I'm going to ignore for the rest of my talk. I'm just going to look at one triangle and see if my D brain is stable or unstable with respect to one particular diagram like this. Well, if psi is 37, then it's not equal to 1. Yeah. Well, I mean, as I hope will become clear, whether or not psi is equal to 1.1, 3.1, 5.1, or 7.1 depends on your choice of base point in the moduli space. So if you choose the base point, then it does matter whether xi is 1.1 or 5.1. And it will be unstable. It will be almost unstable if it's 1.1, and it's way away from being unstable if it's 5.1. You'll see this in examples soon. So last time I did a simple example of the classical notion of a vector bundle at large radius, and I discovered that being stable with respect to a triangle is nothing other than the usual notion of a vector bundle being stable. Namely, we have this number mu. If there's a sub-bundle such that mu of the sub-bundle is higher than mu of the bundle itself, then that destabilizes the bundle. So that's the classical notion. So now let's go to our second example. Again, Douglas was the first person to write this example down. everything from now on, everything from now on is going to be on the quintic threefold. So just the quintic hypersurface in CP4. Now, the reason why the quintic hypersurface in CP4 is a nice example is because B plus ij, there's only one component for B plus ij. So the dimension of moduli space is one. We just got one complex number that specifies B plus ij, which makes life much, much easier. So what I'm going to consider, again, I'm going to build up a triangle which is based on a short exact sequence. The short exact sequence I'm going to take this time is we write it like this. I have to be careful to distinguish between zeros and curly O's. So this is the trivial line bundle, if you like, on X. This is the structure sheaf. This is the structure sheaf twisted by minus n. So n is an integer. If you like, this was the structure sheaf twisted by minus n on the ambient CP4, and I've restricted it to the quintic hypersurface. And this NH, this is the well, in mathematicians' language, this is a non. This is the structure sheaf of a non-reduced scheme, where H is going to be the hyperplane section of X. In physicist language, this is n coincident d brains, d4 brains on H. So I've got my hyperplane H, I take this, the structure sheaf of H, but I'm going to have n times that. So you like, this is a UN bundle on H. Okay. So I've got n four brains piled up on top of each other in this triangle. Sorry?
What's the first map?
There's an obvious map. I mean, this is just polynomials of degree n in the homogeneous coordinate ring of CP4. So I just take any one, yeah. Yeah, I just take any arbitrary polynomial of degree n. No, it's got to vanish. Right, absolutely. Yeah, it's not any one. It's the hyperplane section. It's the linear one raised to the nth power. Yeah. So H is fixed by which linear one that you choose. Yeah. I'm kind of hoping that they're the same thing. I'm really thinking it. In the physicist language, I really want to think that I've got the UN bundle here. Okay. Oh, in that case, I don't. I mean, what I want to do is whatever I've defined here. So you're telling me that this is not the UN bundle on D4?
It's the
formal
bundle.
Ah, okay. So I could deform this to be a UN bundle on D4. Sorry?
Ramas, you remember the paper you wrote where there's difference with this
point. Ah, yes. Okay. This is S equivalent. Is that right? Well, let's not worry too much about the interpretation. I'm just, this is what my definition is of what this thing is here. Okay, and it's a bit like n coincident d4 brains. Whether or not there really is a UN bundle on that or not, we'll leave. Okay. So first, assume that n is very large and B is zero. And I'm also going to assume and J is very large. Well, in order to work out what the... Now, The question is, so this fits into a triangle. When I go to the derived category, this just turns into a triangle. Where my plus one's going to be on this vertex. I want to establish whether this thing is going to be stable or not, whether these end brains are stable. So the map I need is the map phi. So I need to work out what the grade of this map is. So I need to work out the central charge of Ox, and I need to work out the central charge of Ox twisted by minus n. So the central charge of Ox is, like last time, that's the leading order. So I've dropped anything beyond the first order, and minus n okay. So psi phi is 1 over pi times the argument. Remember, there was a minus sign in my definition of psi, so I'm going to take arguments of this minus the argument of this, which is the same as ij minus n over ij cubed, which is 3 over pi times the argument of ij minus n over j. J is... I'm taking b plus ij, I'm thinking of b and j as real numbers now. Okay, so jh is the 2 form, which I get by multiplying h by the real number j. Yeah, I should have mentioned that, sorry. So for stability, pardon? Yeah, I've been quick. This was the integral of e to the ijh times the Chern character of Ox minus n. Okay, the Chern character of Ox minus n is e to the minus nh. Okay. Yeah, sorry, I should have been quite so quick there. So for stability, we require three pi over argument of ij minus n over ij to be less than 1, i.e. inverse tangent of n over j is less than pi over 3 and less than root 3j. It's a decay into that plus that. Okay. So it's a D6, D6 bar pair. Okay. Remember that a shift of 1 takes a brain into a anti-brain. So this is the anti-brain. This is the brain. So what a D6 bar, D6 pair. The D6 bar is has got a first Chern class. That's not a flat bundle. The bundle's twisted. So whether or not it's favored to have these two D6 brains, or whether to have the pile of D4 brains depends on the value of J. So if the ambient space, if the Calabi-Yau threefold is very big, we're going to have N4 brains. Once we get less than a certain size, it's going to decay into the D6, D6 bar pair, which energetically makes sense because the mass of a D6 brain depends on the size of the space. So if the space is really big, you're going to have a hard time making a D6 brain. But once it's energetically favorable to actually make these D6 brains rather than D4 brains, then the D6 brains are going to win. Yep.
When I have this famous triangle, which is formed from a map of complexes and its cone, then I understand the asymmetry in this diagram that it defines stability. Is every distinguished triangle defined in that way?
Every distinguished triangle in a derived category can be written in terms of a cone of a map.
There's always an asymmetry in a distinguished triangle.
One of the map is going to be plus one.
Because it makes a line, it's actually
But which one you choose to be the plus one is up to you. But when you choose one to be the plus one, then the thing at the start of the arrow. So if I chose this to be plus 1, then A can then be written as the cone of B going to C. Okay, so this was the easy computation where I do things in for large n. Let's try and do this computation in an exact way. Let's not take these large radius limits. Let's find out exactly where these D4 brains are going to decay, so we don't have to restrict to a large n. Because, as you'll see, it's more interesting if I can take off the restriction that B was zero. But saying that B was zero is a very artificial constraint. So I need to compute the z's exactly. And to do this, I'm going to use mirror symmetry. So the quintic threefold is mirror to, as has been well known to us for many years, thanks to Greed and Plesser, is mirror to Y, which is an orbifold of a special quintic of the form. So it's a Fermat form So this is the thing I take the orbifold of. Now psi fixes the complex structure. Fixes complex structure of Y. Which means that by mirror symmetry, it therefore maps to B plus IJ. I'm going to call the combination B plus IJ, I'm going to call T. If I've got a lowercase t at any time, I mean B plus IJ of X. So in a way which I'll make clear soon, given a value of psi, which fixes the complex structure of Y, I can map it to, by mirror symmetry, some value of B plus IJ for X. So how does this help me find the Zs? Well, if you remember, these Zs, these central charges, were literally periods on Y. They were literally periods, which means, in particular, they satisfy the Picard-Fix equation. And the Picard-Fix equation is, there's an operator which is usually written called square, dd by dz to the fourth minus the fifth power of 5 times z times d, z plus 1 plus a fifth, by dz plus 2/5. Dz by 4/5. And any period, okay, phi, is killed by this operator. Oh, I haven't told you what z is. Z is a more useful variable than psi. It's 1 over 5 psi to the 5th. So I know whatever my periods are, they better satisfy this differential equation with respect to z. And as I said, there's some weird map, which I'll describe soon, between z and t, b plus ij. Now, let me just sketch the moduli space we're going to be interested in. So we've got one complex degree of freedom, so I'm going to draw it as CP1. And there are three interesting points. There's the point where z is 0, there's the point where psi is 1, and there's the point where psi is 0. So this is the moduli space of Y. This is the moduli space of complex structures on Y. In terms of what the Kähler form on X is, this is going to be the large radius limit. This is the Gettner point. This is a special point where the conformal field theory is particularly easy to write down. Psi is 1 is where things go bad. This is where the conformal field theory that corresponds to a string propagating on X would go singular. And for historical reasons, it's often called the Konnefeld point. Even though X has nothing to do with the Konnefeld. It is, however, true that Y acquires some Konnefeld. It acquires exactly one Konnefeld point, if my memory serves me right. So, take the word Konnefeld with a pinch of salt here. It just means that the conformal field theory is going bad at that point. So, this helps me fix my period somewhat. I know that Z is a linear combination. So the central charge, Z of anything, is a linear combination of the four independent solutions of the Picard-Fuchs system, Picard-Fuchs equation. Well, in this case, it's nice. It's an ordinary differential equation. The reason why going to something more complicated than the quintic is harder is because this ordinary differential equation turns into a set of partial differential equations. Now, the solutions look like so. When I solve, I put this differential equation into Maple, and I ask to solve it around z is zero as a power series. It looks it goes as a power series in positive powers of the logarithm. Then I get down to a constant term. Then I start going up as a power series in Z. So that's what my oh, yes. So that's what my power series solutions, well, they would be power series without the fact that I had logs. This is what my series solutions look like to these differential equations. Sorry, this differential equation. And I claim that we can then use the formula that we have I can then use this formula to pick out exactly which one of the linear combinations I need for a given elements of the derived category F. Just putting dots on there. So in particular, I need to know exactly what I mean by the quantum corrections here. Well, the quantum corrections come in two types. The quantum corrections are either non-perturbative and the non-perturbative corrections are the Wilczek instantons. And I claim that the Wilczek instantons are precisely the variables in Z. These are order Z or higher. This is exactly what the power series in Z is representing. These are the Wilczek instanton terms. So all the corrections which appear as linear in Z or quadratic in Z or higher, I know are the quantum corrections coming from the non-perturbative effect.
Why?
Well, because to leading order, z is going to be e to the, what have I got, minus 2 pi I t. So if I would have stick an alpha primed in here, I'd probably stick it in there. No, because t is b plus ij. So there are power series solutions. So this is the leading order thing. Right, but anything else is an even higher power of the exponential of this thing. So we definitely have an instanton type of behavior if it's a simple polynomial in Z. So that's the interpretation of the polynomial in Z. The other one, which at first sight makes things look horrible, but actually it's not so bad in practice, is that there are some perturbative corrections. Which starts at what's called a for loop term. And this actually means that the quantum corrections start three terms down from the leading log. These start at log z to the p minus 3. So I've got my leading term, then I've got higher loops in the perturbation expansion. When I get down to log z to the p minus 3, the quantum corrections actually start at that point with this for loop term. Sorry? This goes back. I mean, this is the nonlinear Sigma model of n equals 2 theories. Yeah, almost certainly. Right. Yeah, the prepotential for the special Kähler geometry is leading order qubit. Right. But this is an old result due to, who is it? Yeah, Grisari, Zanon, von der Waals. It's a polynomial in T that begins, right, so it goes down to zeroth order, and then we get the exponential of T. Well, we don't need... There may or may not be higher loop corrections, I'm not sure, but certainly within the context of working on a Calabi-Yau threefold, you never need to worry about something higher than four loop, because there's never... Because the highest value of P that I get here is 3.
Yeah, I understand that.
And I've never... Okay, fine. Yeah, I mean, if I were to work on a fourfold rather than a threefold, I would have to worry if there are five loop corrections or not. But since I'm on a threefold, I don't need to worry. So since I know exactly the form of the quantum corrections here, I can...
I'm a little bit confused about this theorem of the quantum corrections. The one thing that the quantum corrections, which start at 4 loops and higher, don't do is change the Kähler class of B plus IJ. And I thought that since we're sort of, roughly speaking, integrating that thing over cycles, all I care about is
the for loop's going to matter. I'm going to show you a slide soon where you'll explicitly see the for loop term, and I have to identify it as a quantum correction. So you'll see explicitly soon.
Actually, that's why I'm confused. And that would answer Perocci's problem, but of course, we're supposed to puzzle for your for loop term.
I definitely need to. I'm going to manifestly see this for loop term in a second, so I need to see it.
The thing that is absolutely true about the quantum correction computed by Grisauer and all is that it does not change the class of the Kähler form, the cohomology class of the Kähler form, the complexity of the Kähler form, if you want. It's an exact correction for it. It's gal bar of a global.
Taylor Clancy's exact Caligiuri model.
Well,
so,
all I know is this. What I know is that the for loop term definitely matters in the mirror map, and it's precisely the mirror map that I'm trying to get at here. I mean, Candela's. Well, I'm confused because the explicit map that is in the Candela-Sedel paper, you need the for loop term, and I'm going to need the for loop term explicitly, otherwise I'm going to get completely crazy answers. Right.
Therefore, when you compute the mirror map, you're matching an exact calculation on one side to the first few terms through the polynomial piece in T of the other.
Right.
And that's why you need the four-loop piece to make the match.
Right.
That's how it shows up in the mirror.
I mean, hopefully it'll be clearer. You're explicitly going to see it. So, I mean, I can't believe that it doesn't matter. So where am I? Lost track of where I am. Okay, so the only other thing I need to tell you is that the there's a thing called the mirror map. The point of the mirror map is to actually map T into these variables psi or z. So it asserts that T is equal to a ratio of two periods, phi 1 and phi 0, where phi 0 is the unique period that begins out at 1 and goes to order z. So this is the period that has no logarithms in. This is just a polynomial. There's only one period which does that. And then there's another period which has precisely one log in and has no constant term. That uniquely fixes phi 1. And then the mirror map asserts that that b plus ij is equal to the ratio of those two periods. Now, I'm not sure if I can give a history. I haven't been keeping up to date with how rigorously we know that the mirror map is true. I think the mathematicians have rigorously established that this is right by work by Giventhal and people like this, because this mirror map tells you how to count rational curve-like things on the target space.
Well, the Giventhal and Yao et al. Work doesn't actually do mirror symmetry. It shows that the computational method that mirror symmetry use to predict the answers to innumerable questions
right.
is correct.
Right.
But it has nothing to do with the mirror.
Right, so therefore, in order for the mirror map to be consistent with what is known from counting the rational curve-like things, this must be true. Okay. So I will claim that this has been rigorously established, at least in the context of the quintic. I'm not quite sure what how many examples there. Okay. So, let me... Right. Right, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, so, rather than write down the periods, which are fairly horrible, I'm going to show a slide as to how this works exactly. Let me just mention there are some things called Barnes integrals on this slide. Which are an integral in the complex plane, which is going to be called the S plane. So if I put the origin there, then the complex integral in question is going to be from minus I infinity to plus I infinity, very, very close to the right-hand side of the vertical axis. So that's the path of integration in the... I think I'm about to show.
What's S?
S is a complex variable which appears in the integral.
Okay.
Okay, so these are the periods. The first thing I write down is a basis of the periods. So this pi 0 to pi 3 are going to form a basis. So this is a power series in Z, which I claim solves the differential equation. Then I write down four periods, phi 0, phi 1, phi 2, and phi 3. And I use the Barnes integral to write it as both a power series in positive powers of Z and a power series in negative powers of Z. So this is the term which has no logs in. Okay, this is a power series in Z. So this was the thing I just called phi zero. And in terms of the basis for large values of Z, this is just equal to pi zero. Then I have the thing that I called phi one, which by the definition of the mirror map is leading order T. You can work out that it's in this. That in terms of the pi basis is equal to that. Then I write down another one which starts out as log squared, which therefore, because of the mirror map, I interpret this as t squared, this is t, this is just a constant, and then I get the quantum corrections after that. Then at phi 3, I get this horrible thing here with an I zeta 3 in. Everybody who's played with for loop terms instantly recognizes this as the for loop term. So this is a quantum correction. This doesn't really, this should be considered zero when I'm comparing to the leading order behavior of the Zs. So I'm going to treat this as if it's t cubed minus 7 half t, and this is the way it is in the basis that I used.
Is this an integral basis?
Then? Integral with respect to what? No, I think it's probably just rational. It may be integral. What I know for sure is that it's rational. Okay, so this is the basis that I use. And this gives me, so if I write down one of the integrals, the exponential of t times chain character times the square root of the Todd class, that gives me the leading order in terms of t. I then find the corresponding big phis which give me that leading order behavior, which therefore tells me how to write it in terms of the pi's. So I can solve this thing exactly. If you give me a given Chern character for anything in a derived category, I can immediately tell you what the big Z of that thing is, just by writing it down as a linear combination of these periods.
Near large radius.
Near large radius or near small radius. I mean, I've got a power series that converges near small radius in terms of the omegas, and in terms of the large radius in terms of the t's and z's.
You're assuming a certain path connected large.
Absolutely, yeah. And analytic continuation will be used to get anywhere else, which, as we see, is going to cause lots of fun. Okay, so this is the story behind. I guess I shouldn't have lifted the screen up. So I solve it exactly. And what we discover for the lines of marginal stability for the D brains is the following. So this is the case where n is 1, n is 2, 3, 4, 5 is a bit hard to see because it's in yellow, 6 and 7. So what is this graph? Well, this is the B plus IJ plane. So this is B going in this direction, and this is J going in the vertical direction. Now, these funny regions drawn in gray are a fundamental region of the moduli space. So if I just take the moduli space, which, as I said, is a Riemann sphere, and I try and map that moduli space into the B plus J plane, then I'll get one of the regions which has got this point at the bottom and then goes up vertically there and goes up vertically there. Now, the symmetry that B is the same as B plus 1 tells you that a fundamental region of the moduli space must lie between 0 and 1, or 1 and 2, 2 and 3, etc. So at first, you restrict yourself to one of the fundamental regions that I've drawn here. So draw a line vertically up from there and a line vertically up from there.
What's the width?
1.
What's the graph on the tip from the bottom?
This is the B field. This is B goes along the bottom. This is the B plus IJ plane. Sorry? The cunnifold points are these points here. So this is the Gapner point. The arrow at the bottom is the Gapner point. This is the cunnifold point. And obviously the large radius limit has gone off the top of the screen because that's
so
where...
It's a union of a bunch of gradients, not a
single point. It's take from there to there. So take from that cunnifold point to a copy of the cunnifold point. Go up. Yeah, so these actual grey lines are just shadings in of one fundamental region. If I'd have had more time, then I could have done a bold black line going up from there and a bold black line coming up from there. So a fundamental region goes from 0 to 1, or 1 to 2, or 2 to 3, etc. So as we said last time, as I come down from large radius limit, depending on how big n is, I'm going to hit the line where the ND4 brains become unstable. So above these lines, the ND4 brains are stable. Below these lines, I'm going to favor the D6 bar pair. So B is zero, I was going up this line here. This is the B is zero line. And indeed, if you look here, you'll find that N is approximately root 3, sorry, that N is approximately root 3 times J, which is the last thing that we've... Right, well, this is the fun thing about the definition of the period. The analytic continuation of the differential equations means that the periods are not single-valued in the moduli space. I can go round and round the cunnifold points or large radius limit, and the value of the period will change. So even though you think there's a B goes to B plus 1 symmetry, the periods don't like that symmetry. So in particular, you'd have thought that you can't reach the Gapner point. I told you that once the size of the target space is less than a certain size, the ND4 brains decay into D6 bar. Well, that's not quite right. If I start up here, I can analytically continue around here, evade these lines, and end up at the Gapner point down there. So I can go all the way to the Gapner point without crossing these lines of decay into D6 bar. Pass. Well, that's up to you. You see, this is exactly why the choice of base point is so important. I've got to begin at large radius limit somewhere. I've got to start at large radius limit and decide what I mean by a bunch of D4 brains. Then I analytically continue the periods anywhere and follow what that D4 brain's doing. So the physical interpretation is not just a point on the moduli space. It's a point on the moduli space complete with a path from the base point. So it's as if I need the universal cover of the moduli space to really have a well-defined function.
So it's not clear that if you consider a lot more decay processes, you get a lot more lines.
Oh, sure, yeah. This is one triangle, yeah.
So you might not be able to get that.
Right. But there's no obvious modification of this triangle to stop me doing it. It'd have to be a totally new triangle, which would stop me from doing it. But I certainly can't claim that it doesn't exist. Okay, so we see, I mean, this is the main point, that the choice of base point is so important. If I choose B to be, if I fix the value of B here, then I can change B goes to B plus 8 over here somewhere, and it's a completely different theory. Certainly, if I, that is trivially true because I can just take any triangle and I can twist it by a certain line bundle and that will shift it one place left. But the problem is this condition of the triangle only making sense if the decay products are stable. And I think that's where you're going to again break the symmetry. Okay, so this is so this tells you how to make the four brains unstable. Okay, so thus far we've been talking about fairly classical objects. I've been talking about a thing that we recognize as D4 brains. Let me do something more exotic. This is our third example. So let me just do the exact version. So what we had last time was O of, let's say, minus 1. So the single D4 brain I basically got from this map here. If phi is an element of HOM minus 1 to O0. Now, because of surduality, this group is isomorphic to X3 of O into O minus 1. Because of surduality. So consider, I'm going to keep my notation, phi to be any old map in X3 of 0, 0, minus 1, which I know is a non-trivial group because this is a non-trivial group. So we have, sorry? This is the quintic. So just think of these sheaves on CP4 and then restrict to the clavier. So we have, so what does this mean? It means I have O going to O minus 1. Now the definition of X3 is I have to shift, when I go to the derived category, I was calling these X3s, I was calling these HOM3s. What it means is that it's a map between O and O minus 1 shifted left by 3. So that's what this thing is. So I can complete this to a triangle with the cone of that map. So so this is an object in the derived category, which is a cone, this X, looks more like H, cone of phi, which is a map from this to O minus 1, shifted by 3. Okay. Well, I use it as, I said that I defined it as being an X3. So I write down an injective resolution of the sheaf, and then it's a map from O to the third place in the injective resolution. So I can't explicitly tell you what it is. All I can tell you is that I know it exists by surduality. So we just know that there is a map here. Right.
The phi and phi prime represent the same object in the same morphism in the derived category?
No, because they're going between different objects.
One turns the other, but they're not.
But they're manifesting between different objects, so they're certainly not isomorphic.
So the cones are different objects in the derived category.
Sorry?
So the cones are different objects.
Yeah, this is absolutely a different object in the derived category to the D4 brain. Even its Chern character is different. I mean, it's just manifestly a different object.
Oh, I guess technically the duality was to the dual X3. So an element in one doesn't give you an element, but it gives you a function.
I thought I just had to swap the order of the things in the X.
Yeah, but the space is actually is the dual
vector. Oh, okay, fine. Okay, but just all I need is the fact that that vector space is non-trivial. All I need is the existence of a map phi. Okay. Now when I work out this, the weight of this phi. When I'm at very large radius limit, I claim that the value of psi for this phi is approximately 3. The fact I've shifted left here by 3 places, so in the large radius limit, in the large radius limit, it's fairly easy to show that both z of, I mean, you could see this from last time. That that both of these z's go as a cubic power of t, so they're roughly the same. which means that if I hadn't got the shift of 3 here, the weight of phi would be approximately 0. But since I got a shift of 3 here, the grade of phi is closer to 3. So this phi starts out life as being value 3. I'm not sure I can. I mean, I'm in a derived category, and you'll see. I mean, the reason I'm doing this is that I'm going to end up with something that I don't know how to interpret in terms of D-brain. So I've got a triangle which exists in a derived category, and these things were D6 brains, but now I've shifted this by 3. So in particular, this was an anti D6 brain pair. Now, if anything, the anti D6 brain has been turned into a D6 brain. Because I've shifted it by 3, which has therefore changed an anti-brain into a brain.
And you can't tell us what the thing.
I can't tell you what the what is.
No.
That's exactly what I can't tell you. But what I can tell you is that in the large radius limit, it is unstable, because this number psi is bigger than 3. It's exactly, well, if we knew what the topological field theory of that was, then we knew what the topological field theory of that was, which we do. As I said last time, I can generate this just by a cone of that to that. So it's a deformation of the topological field theory, which has these two D-brains in, where the deformation is given by this map. Where well... You can compute anything that you want to. I gave you the exact recipe. Yeah. Yeah. I'll give an exact claim as to what it is. Let me make an exact claim in a minute, but let me just first of all emphasize that if we're working in a large radius limit, we don't care what this thing is because it's unstable. Okay. And I hope this is going to be a reasonably general feature of these weird objects, is that at large radius limit, they'll be unstable. It's certainly true in this case. Well, all I've done so far is construct 2 D6 brains, and I've told you that the potential tachyon map between them actually isn't a tachyon. It's got positive mass squared, so it's not going to bind these two D6 brains together. Right, you're saying what I'm about to get to, I think. All I've said so far is this is unstable at large radius. I'm about to say that we can make it stable. So this is unstable at large radius limit, but now I go through the machinery of the periods. I'd already worked out what these periods were, so I can find out what this real value of what the real number psi of phi does, and I can ask as I go down in radius, is there a point where this number falls below one? If this number falls below one as I decrease the size, then this thing is going to become stable. And indeed, oops, not that one. So what's this? So you'll recognize the fundamental region that we started with. It was this shape here. Okay? So this is the Gapner point. These are the conifold points here. This is Candelas's scorpion diagram, it's sometimes called this. It first appeared in his paper with Dell'Orso, Green and Parks. So this is the large radius, this is the conifold point, this is the Gapner point here. So we come down from large radius limit, and lo and behold, we hit this line. And that line is precisely where the grade of that map is 1, and the grade of the map is less than 1 here. So this weird-looking object becomes stable once we go under this line. Now, what's interesting about this line here is that it's gone outside this region here. It's gone into the next region here. Now, this region here is another copy of the of the whole of the moduli space. This is another fundamental region, if you like, in the B plus IJ plane. Now, notice that this one of the key points about the quinting is that it doesn't do the same thing as the torus would. In the case of the two torus, for example, this upper half, this B plus IJ plane looks like the upper half plane, and the fundamental regions you get are got by taking the upper half plane and modding out by SL2Z in the usual way, which means that the fundamental regions tessellate in a nice way. For the quintic, these fundamental regions do not tessellate. Clearly, if I shift this whole thing by 1, which is the B goes to B plus 1 map, these fundamental regions are going to copy various points in the upper half plane, which they shouldn't do. overlaps are going to happen.
So in this other region, is the large radius limit at a point where everything goes?
This is the large radius limit, yeah.
So is there another line of marginal stability I would cross if I go off to there? Or is this object stable in that large radius limit?
I believe it's stable in that large radius limit. Which is, well, no, because you see, this is the important choice about base points, is that our base point, where we think that we understand geometry, is up there.
Yes. So
in a different basis. No, but it means that you've reinterpreted things. You've got to translate the geometry back to here. And if you reinterpret it back to right, fine. So it's an object in a derived category at that large radius limit. The question is, what object is it? And if I map this back to here, I'm going to have to change all the objects into other objects. This will become clear in the next example. There's got to be a non-trivial map between a derived category back to itself to reinterpret these objects. In this case, I don't. And it's an interesting question. So even though this is a weird-looking object in terms of the geometry up there, it might not be so weird when we reinterpret things in terms of the derived category down there.
Do you know that they're less?
They must be, but I don't know what it is in this case, but I could probably work it out. That's an interesting question. When I drew this graph, I hadn't thought of reinterpreting it in terms of there, but one could certainly do that. We have enough technology at our disposal. So the analytic continuation I've got to do just here to get myself in another fundamental region gives me this shape here as a fundamental region, as opposed to the previous graph where the analytic continuations were just giving me shifts of this region here. Okay. Now, I was going to plot this graph for higher values of n. I think if we did the line of O going to O minus 2, what I think should happen is that it comes out of here, it follows this path and then hits that conifold point there. But I couldn't quite get my program to work properly. It was my program would follow it down to about here and then crash horribly. So once I found a bug, I'm sure I can make it carry on to that point there. Okay.
Yep. Do you know how the central charge of an object and its dual are related in general?
Well, in terms of the way I've described it here, there's clearly the sum of the two things is going to be 3. Okay, because I've just flipped the order of the map, which will change the sign, but then I've shifted things by 3. So the map, so one is going to be 3 minus the other.
Is it true that for any process there's some line of marginal stability, and in the dual process, whatever is stable on this side, the dual object is stable.
Right. It would be particularly nice if the relationship were 2 minus it, because then I could say that just as one thing goes stable, the other one becomes unstable. So as one crosses above 1, the other one would go less than 1. Unfortunately, the relationship here is that they sum to 3 rather than they sum to 2. So you can't quite say that one becomes unstable just at the same time as the other one goes stable. But for the K3 case, it should work. The lines should match up correctly. So that was our third example. Again, Douglas was the first person to write down this example. He did it for large n in a similar way to we did the other large n. This is the version for 1. Yeah. Right. Well. Let me just say one thing about this thing, which is about the only thing that I know about it, is that, let's say some objects in the derived category are quasi-isomorphic to complexes with maps 0. So what I mean is that I have a complex which now a particular value, a particular kind of complex is the complex where I just put zeros. So I'll say that this complex is equal to its cohomology. And if you have such a complex that's equal to its cohomology, you can picture it pretty much as that D-brain plus that D-brain plus that, sorry, that D-brain minus that D-brain plus that D-brain minus that D-brain plus that D-brain. So in this case, you definitely have a sum of D-brains. Now, the problem is only some of the objects in the derived category can be written in this form. And I'm 90% sure that this object X cannot be written in this form. Right. That's right. So, right. That's right. So the only way in D-brains you can think about this is you begin with a set of D-brains, you turn on the maps, you let the maps decay into something, but what you end up with is not a sum of D-brains. You can begin with a sum of D-brains, but the ultimate ground state is not just a. Well, I've told you it's the mapping. So, I mean, I've written in terms of an injective resolution, which means I've written it in a particularly obscure form. But it does exist. I mean, this is the only way that I've written the map. Okay. Pardon? Well, all I've shown is that it's stable with respect to this triangle. So I certainly haven't proven that it really does exist in a physical theory, but at least it's passed this test. That the triangle which would naturally destabilize it is not destabilizing it once you get down to a certain size.
Is there a case,
That's interesting. I believe the answer to that question is yes. Douglas told me that the answer is yes. I don't know the details.
That usually doesn't correspond to a vertex operator which is massless or tachyonic in the physical theory.
It's very massive.
What?
It's massive. Right, its mass squared is greater than
right.
zero, so it'd be a funny thing to describe, right, to write this down in life.
So, it's a little bit...
So, it's not until we... Right.
That can correspond to something which, you might turn on the physical theory condense.
Right, but it's only going to condense once I've taken the radius down so the thing no longer is massive. I've got to be much closer to the Gettner point to even start doing this.
No, given from charge,
yeah. This thing, I should say, by the way, that this was an object which appeared close to the Gettner point. So you might first guess, well, okay, if I'm not close to the Gettner point, then I'm not going to get such strange objects. But actually, you can build these strange objects for any size target space that you wish. I can kind of wind this construction up with sticking ends in this and take those ends to large values, and I can make these weird looking objects in a derived category stable for an arbitrarily large target space. Okay. So we're always going to have to confront these. No, because there's a size above which they will always decay, but that size can be arbitrarily large, but it can be much bigger than alpha prime. In which case, I guess they should have a supergravity description, which means... Yeah, so there's a large N, so it's making life hard for you. Well, if they do, I don't know what it is. Anyway, let me give my last example. EG4. What about zero brains? So how stable is a point? So of course these correspond to skyscraper sheaves of a point. Are these points stable? Well, the triangle that we're going to write down to address this question is the triangle I get from the following short sequence in the category of current sheaves. So this is the skyscraper sheaf, and this is the ideal sheaf of a point. So let's see if a point is stable, or let's see if the ideal sheaf is stable with respect to, in fact, let's see if the structure sheaf is stable with respect to this triangle. Let's check all three. Now, to get an interesting triangle, okay, the triangle that we first write down would obviously be this one. Okay. But this triangle is kind of boring when you analyze what goes on. So instead of that triangle, I'm just going to shift this guy by one and move the one map there. Okay. So this is a triangle just as much as the first triangle that I wrote down was. So what are the periods? For, well, the period for OP is the really easy one. That's the thing I call phi zero. And O is something that we can use the method which I wrote down earlier. We can find this. And once you found two of the periods, you found the third, because the Chern character of this is the Chern character of that plus that, so therefore I can easily write down the third period, once I've got the first two. It's just the sum of them. It's like that period must be that period plus that period. Now, shuffle the order of my notes a little bit here. We've done this. Ah, good. I've got my diagram here. Well, what we find when we look at this, what we find is that the period for the structure sheaf OX this vanishes at the conifold point. You can prove that using the method I mentioned of explicitly finding what the periods are. And people had kind of known as well. People had known that something had to vanish at the conifold point in order for the theory to be bad. The fact that the something whose central charge vanishes at the conifold point is kind of why the conifold point is there. The physics is becoming bad because there's a soliton whose mass goes to zero. So actually this tells us that in addition to this thing, this period going to zero at that point, that we have pretty good reason to think that this thing is stable all the way down to that point. So at least in this case, we know that something's stable. So this is what gives you the conifold point. So you can let me also say that the value of phi zero, which is the z of the skyscraper, is finite and non-zero. If you use the power series that I wrote down on that slide, the first slide that I showed, you can actually see that those power series will actually still be convergent even when you get to the conifold point, even though that is the limit of the radius of convergence. So, what you end up with is this. So, in the B plus IJ plane, I have my large radius limits up here. And I can go, let's follow a path in the moduli space that goes around and to the right of the conifold point. And let me call this angle here theta. So I have an angle theta which starts out at zero and then it's going to increase as I go around the conifold, as I follow this path in the moduli space. And it is easy to show, if you analyze these periods, that the corresponding grades, but the corresponding size look like this. So those are the psis that we have on this triangle as we go around the conifold point. This is an exact answer if you're very close to the conifold point. So right, so to leading order, when you're very, very close to the conifold point, as you go around there.
I think the answer was yes.
Okay. This is exactly true. So what does this show us? Well, theta has started out life as being, so at the start, theta is zero. This is at large radius limit. What we can see is that the line bundle, the structure sheaf is stable. Indeed, it's always stable. This number zero is always less than one. The structure sheaf is always stable. The ideal sheaf is unstable because I have number three halves, which is bigger than one. Okay. So the ideal sheaf of a point is unstable at large radius limit, which is kind of nice because we didn't expect to get a D6. In fact, if I could remember names, people had already shown this. I apologize for not being able to remember the authors of a paper about 2 years ago where they showed using other methods that the ideal sheaf of a point, basically a D6, D0 bar pair, are unstable at large radius limit. Okay. I can't remember who the authors are, much to my... Yeah, sure. Right. Right. That's right. In flat space, there is a repulsive force between a D0 bar and a D6 spring, which is just saying that this is true. But the structure sheaf of a point is stable because this is equal to minus a half, which is less than one. So a D0 brain is stable at large radius limit. Good. When we cross. When we cross here, what's going to happen? Well, what's going to happen is that the ideal sheaf is going to become stable. Okay. So this repulsive force that was between the D0 bar D6 has gone from being repulsive to attractive.
And it's well known that can be stable on pretty much D0.
Sorry?
And it's also well known that in some flat space that can be stable on pretty much
D0. Right, okay. And you could do the... Right, you could do the similar computation. Yeah, if you... Right. Fine. This is still stable. Let's keep going around here to here and try and get back to where we started with. What we find is that when we cross, what happens when theta becomes bigger than 3 pi over 2? Well, at that point, this becomes bigger than 1, so the D0 brain becomes unstable. The ideal sheaf is still stable. Okay. So we can destabilize the zero brain if we go outside a fundamental region of the moduli space. I've drawn a path here where I've managed to destabilize the zero brain. Now, what I really like about this example is that it shows that you need something like the derived category to get this to work. Normally when you think of things as being stable, normally if you analyze something and you want to know if some D brain is stable with respect to decay into other D brains, you think of one of the D brains as somehow being a natural sub-object of a D brain that you start with. This shows that you can't think of any of these things as being sub-objects of the other. I've got one case where one of the vertices becomes unstable and another case where another vertex is unstable. So the triangles are absolutely essential. I can't just use a a notion of a sequence to say that something is a subobjective something else. In other words, to use fancy languages, we must be an additive category rather than an abelian category. Which means, however you want to formulate D-brains, you're never going to be able to do it in terms of an abelian category because of this way that something can decay into something else, but the something else can decay back into the something later on. There's no way I can think of the ideal sheep as being bigger than a point or a point being bigger than the ideal sheep. It's a purely subjective statement. Sorry? Well, okay, triangulated. I mean, additive is even less restrictive than a triangulated. Abelian means the existence of... an abelian, one thing you definitely need is the existence of kernels and co-kernels. For abelian, yeah. Additive just means that there is an abelian group structure on the morphisms, which I definitely used. I mean, my morphisms are open strings which live in a vector space. So there is an abelian group action. Okay. Yeah, I think some people do. Yeah. Okay. We can call this ab if you want. But anyway. Right. Certainly the key issue here is that I think that we've killed the existence of kernels and co-kernels because we've killed the notion of a sub-object. Okay. Right. Right, but both descriptions, right. So I could use some so-called T-structures to find an abelian category, but that T-structure could only be valid in part of the moduli space. It couldn't be valid for the whole time that I went around the Konnefeld point. Yep.
Well, I have another question. Often people like to think of
zero
brains in terms of quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Is there supposed to be some...
I don't feel qualified. I don't feel qualified to answer that question. I have asked that question of Eva, for example, and she said that she's not too worried about it. But I didn't understand the answer that she gave me, so I can't give any better answer than that. At first sight, it does look worrying that the D0 brains are unstable, and yet some people try to use D0 brains as basic objects. Right.
Don't you also need right. Well, okay, that's my question. I mean, you're just saying that the user of range is not stable. So
right.
There should be some instability.
Yeah, I have no idea what the answer to this question is.
What happens if you run this with N B0 brains instead of one? Have you done it?
I haven't done it. I haven't tried it.
Because for the quantum mechanics you want.
Oh, it's... Anyway, let me just close with the following statement. This example suggests... I think I can make a stronger statement than this, but let me just make this weaker statement, that somehow the ideal sheaf of a point is replaced by the ideal sheaf of a point shifted by one for a loop around the Konnefeld.
Is that what?
Right.
So that you get the same.
Right. Right. The ideal sheaf would be d6 plus d6 0 bar, but the fact it's shifted by 1 means it's d6 0 d6 yeah, bar plus d.
The ideal sheaf would carry d6 ray charge.
Yeah.
The other thing.
Right. So, in order to reinterpret what we have, so we've gone from one set of objects to another set of objects as we loop around the conifold point. So this implies that there's monodromy as we go around the conifold. Now the monodromy must bring us, in terms of intrinsic physics, we must get back to where we started with. Okay. So let me just say quickly that this implies that it's an auto-equivalence of a derived category. The essential physical content can't change as we go around the loop. The interpretation in terms of geometry can sure as heck change, and it has done, but the underlying derived category mustn't have changed. So somehow we must have a non-trivial map of the derived category back onto itself. I haven't told you how I defined it yet. I'm just saying that I see that a point seems to have turned into IP shifted by 1, and I just claim this is part of some big action as I go around the conifold, and it must be an auto equivalence because physics must be invariant.
This is the wave.
Right? Sure. Yep. Sorry? It is true that the topological field theory that I wrote down with, that I began with, does not depend on B plus IJ, but I've manifestly given you an example of turning one object into another object. It must be an auto equivalence because I mustn't have changed physics when I've gone around this loop. I'm just claiming that, well, if you like, the topological field theory, which didn't know about B plus IJ, must have been mapped back to itself in a non-trivial way. It didn't know about stability, but because physics, where things, I do care about. It does, right.
But globally, they do not right. Come back up to an auto equivalent.
Right. Now, any auto equivalence, any auto equivalence is induced by a Fourier-McKay transform. And unfortunately, I don't have time to go through this, but let me just quote that it's that the obvious Fourier-McKay transform consistent with this. I think, given a little more time, I can prove that this has to be the Fourier-McKay transform. That it's the only one that's consistent with this. Is well, again, I'm speaking only to people who know about the definition of a Fourier-McKay transform. It's induced by the object, which is given by this, where this is the diagonal, x in x times x. And this was conjectured many years ago to be exactly the Fourier-McKay transform which you get by going around the conifold point. This was conjectured by Konsevich. And more work has been done on this by Horger, Morrison, and Seidel and Thomas. This is back in about 94, I think. 96, sorry.
Consensus earlier conjecture was 94.
Yeah, okay, I'm getting this too much. So this, I think, can be turned into a nice proof of this thing which was conjectured many years ago, and the conjecture didn't really have much of a basis. All that they could tell was that the Chern characters were behaving in the right way. This actually nails exactly what the objects here in the derived category of x times x should be. So this gives you the monodromy going around the this point, this bad point in the moduli space of the CFT. Okay, I think that's where I'll stop. Thanks.
We're just gonna